Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone Smoke Jensen, The Mountain Man number 36, Violence of the Mountain Man. Narrated by Terrence Aselford, with performances by James Lewis, Drew Copus, Elizabeth Jernigan, Richard Rowan, Tim Carlin, Alyssa Wilmoth, Johan Detweiler, Thomas Penny, David Coyne, Nick DePinto, Thomas Keegan, Bradley Smith, Alexander Strain, Joe Brack, Yasmin Toison, Eric Messner, Dylan Lynch, Terrence Aselford, Nanette Savard, MJ Casey, Colleen Delaney, Stephen Carpenter, and Ken Jackson.
That smells so good.
Lucy Goodnature watched Sally Jensen pull apple pies from the oven.
You'll have to tell me all your secrets.
Lucy, one thing that you must learn is that a woman never tells.
Oh, of course. I didn't mean all your secrets. I just meant
that... I know what you meant. I was just teasing you.
Oh, well, I do want to learn how to make apple pie the way you do. I know Pearlie really likes your apple pie.
Honey, there's one thing that isn't a secret. When it comes to eating, there is very little that Pearlie doesn't like.
Lucy walked over to look through the window.
All the cowboys seem to be having such a good time. It's very nice of Mr. Jensen to give them all a going-away party like this. It was very nice of you to invite me. Thank you.
Oh, you are welcome, Lucy. You have been a big help to me today. I know that Pearlie was glad to see you, and any friend of Pearlie's is always welcome at the Sugarloaf.
Lucy was the 19-year-old daughter of Ian Goodnature, the owner of a ranch that was adjacent to Smoke Jensen's Sugarloaf Ranch. Tall and willowy, with long black hair and green eyes, she had attracted Pearlie's attention as no other woman ever had.
I'd like to think... What I mean to say is... I would like to think that I'm more than just a friend to Pearlie.
I wouldn't be surprised if you weren't more than just a friend. But take it from someone who's older, if not wiser. You don't rush these things. Men always like to believe they are in charge. So you're going to have to let Pearlie take the lead.
Yes, ma'am. I know.
Yes, ma'am. Lucy, I said I was older, but I'm not ancient. Ma'am is something you say to old people.
Oh, yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. Oh, I said it again.
On the large and well-kept lawn outside the house, Smoke Jensen walked over to a wood fire to check on the meat. He stood there for a moment, watching as Juan Mendoza turned the spit slowly and Carlos Rodriguez applied barbecue sauce to the already glistening carcass of half a steer. The aroma of the cooking meat filled the grounds between the group of small houses where Juan, Carlos, and the other permanent hands lived, and the house where Smoke and Sally Jensen, owners of Sugarloaf Ranch, lived. The American cowboys called the ranch house the Big House. The Mexicans called it Casa Grande. The cowboys, separate from the permanent hands, lived in a bunkhouse. The bunkhouse, which was between the big house and the barn, was a long, low building and had 10 bunks, 5 on each side of the building, as well as private rooms at each end of the bunkhouse. The private rooms provided quarters for Pearlie and Cal, the only 2 cowboys who were permanent employees. The rest of the cowboys who rode for Sugarloaf were, like most cowboys, men who worked the ranches as temporary hands, hired in the spring for the roundup and branding, then let go during the winter months. This was typical of all the ranches, and the cowboys not only accepted it, but many of them had chosen this particular line of work for the very reason that it was seasonal and temporary. The time of employment for the extra hands was now coming to an end, and as they did every year, Smoke and his wife Sally were hosting a barbecue and party for the cowboys. Juan and Carlos had started cooking the beef the evening before, taking turns watching it through the night. Their long efforts had been rewarded, and now the meat was nearly done. In the meantime, many of the Mexican women had prepared their own dishes to bring to the meal, and Sally had baked pies. One of the American cowboys, Lucas Kino, was pretty good with a pistol, and in head-to-head shooting with the others, he had bested them all. Kino was a singularly unattractive man, with an oversized, hawk-like nose, thin lips, bad teeth, and a weak chin.
Ha! There ain't a cowboy on this ranch can beat me. Hell, there ain't a cowboy in the whole county can beat me, and none in the state either, I'm betting.
Kino, you might want to think about that some. No matter how good you are, there's always someone who is better.
Yeah? Well, if there's somebody better, I'd like to know who it could be. I've done beat everybody in Sugarloaf, and that's a fact.
You haven't beat everybody. I've seen you shoot, and I've seen Pearlie shooting. I think Pearlie's better.
Do you now? Is that right, Pearlie? You better than me?
I don't know.
Tell you what, I just got paid out my $30. Why don't me and you bet that $30 on which one of us is the best? I could use an extra 30.
I don't want to bet you.
I reckon you don't. What you mean is, you don't want to lose the money.
No, I don't want to lose the money.
Don't know why you'd be so worried about losing $30. Hell, being as you and Cal are Jensen's pets, you don't get fired like the rest of us. You get yourself another 30 come next month.
You ain't being fired, Kino. You know coming in that this was a temporary job. All roundups are temporary jobs. Hell, that's what cowboying is all about.
Yeah, so you say. But from the way I'm looking at it, it's the same as being fired. All right, you don't want to bet. At least shoot against me so I can prove I'm better.
Aiming at one of the empty cans that had been set up for a target, Kino pulled the trigger. He hit the can, knocking it into the air. Then he shot again, hitting the can a second time and knocking it farther back.
Can you do that?
Probably not.
Ha! Then admit it. I'm better than you.
We aren't going to find out.
Yeah, well, I don't blame you none. I mean, let's face it. As long as you don't shoot against me, you'll have your puppy Cal convinced you can beat me.
It's not something we'll ever want to find out.
Oh? And why not?
Because if we do find out, one of us will be dead.
The bell called everyone back up to the lawn of the big house. There, two long tables had been set up under the arching aspen trees and were now loaded with dishes, eating utensils, and several large bowls of such things as beans, rice, corn, steaming tortillas, and cornbread. Juan and Carlos stood proudly by the glazed beef, carving off generous portions to serve the men. Pearlie filled his plate with beef.
Tell you what, Pearlie, why don't you pass your plate around for the rest of us to divide up and you can just eat the rest of the cow your own self?
Well, folks say you show a cook how much you enjoy their cooking by how much of their food you eat. I just didn't want Juan or Carlos thinking I don't appreciate them.
As all the cowboys and the permanent hands enjoyed their meal, Smoke stood up.
I want to thank all of you, cowboys and ranch hands, for helping to make Sugarloaf one of the most successful ranches in the entire state!
State in the entire West!
Now that the seasonal employment is over, many of you will be going on to other things. And I wish you all the best, and hope that you can all come back to ride for us again next spring.
Finally, with the dinner ended and the ladies of the ranch cleaning up, the cowboys who were leaving mounted their horses, then gathered near the porch where Smoke stood to bid them all goodbye.
Boys, I want you to know this. If the going gets too hard for you come winter, you're more than welcome to come back here. I won't have any work for you to do, but if all you need is food for your bellies, a place to keep warm, and a pillow to lay your head, you've got it at the Sugarloaf.
With that, the cowboys galloped away. Smoke and Sally waved to them from the porch. Those ranch hands who were permanent employees had come out of their cabins to wave goodbye as well.
We had a good bunch of hands this year.
Except for one. I've already told him privately not to come back next year.
You have to be talking about Lucas Kino.
Yeah, I'm talking about Lucas Kino. He was all complaint and little work. Should have fired him weeks ago.
Pearlie and Cal were standing over in front of the bunkhouse, and like the others, they had waved and shouted their goodbyes to the cowboys as they rode out.
How many of them you think will be back come spring?
Most of them, I reckon. You're too young to know any better, because this is about the only place you've ever worked, but I've worked at other ranches, and I'll tell you true, there is no better place on God's green earth for a cowboy to work than to work for Smoke and Sally here on the Sugarloaf.
I know this is the only place I ever worked, but I already figured that out for myself.
Come on, Cal. What do you say we give Carlos and Juan a hand getting things cleaned up?
All right.
Oh, Pearly, wait a minute.
Yes, ma'am.
When Mr. Goodnature dropped Lucy off, I promised we would get her back home. Would you mind doing it? You can use the Surrey.
Well, I'd be glad to. Miss Lucy, you just wait right here. I'll hitch up the team and be back for you before you can say Jack Robinson.
Oh, thank you, Pearly. That's very kind of you.
Want me to come along with you, Pearly?
The thing of it is, Cal,
if you don't mind, why don't you stay here and help me with something?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I don't mind.
True to his promise, Pearly was back in very little time. He helped Lucy into the Surrey, then drove off.
What do you have for me to do?
What?
You said you wanted me to help you with something. What is it?
Nothing, I guess.
But you said... Oh, I know now. You just said that because you wanted to give Pearly a chance to be alone with Miss Lucy, didn't you?
Something like that, yes.
Well, I hope it works. Pearly sure is crazy about that girl. I don't think she even knows he's alive.
Oh, she knows.
You mean she's sweet on him?
Let us just say that nature is gradually beginning to work its course.
I like that. Nature working its course. Well, if you really don't have anything for me, I think I'll go give Carlos and Juan a hand.
I'm sure they will appreciate it.
What was all that about?
You haven't noticed Pearly and Lucy?
Noticed them? What do you mean, noticed them?
Smoke, Jensen, to be as smart as you are in so many things, I'm sometimes surprised to discover how incredibly dumb you are in others.
Oh? You mean Pearly and Lucy are, like... that?
Maybe you aren't all that dumb after all.
The drive from Sugarloaf over to Crosshatch, which was the name of the ranch Ian Goodnature owned, was about 5 miles. And with a spirited team pulling the Surrey, Pearly covered the distance in about 20 minutes. He and Lucy talked during the drive, but it was of inconsequential things, because Pearly was too self-conscious to bring up any subject more substantive than the scenery or the weather. He turned off the main road and up the long drive to Lucy's house, feeling a sense of frustration and disappointment with himself because he'd been unable to let her know how he felt about her, or to feel her out as to how she felt about him. He pulled the team to a halt in front of the steps, then, wrapping the reins around a davit on the dashboard, hopped down from the Surrey and hurried around to help Lucy down.
I'm real glad you were able to come over today.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't have missed it for anything in the world. It was great fun. Well, I suppose I'd better get on inside.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Thanks for driving me home.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Lucy started toward the porch.
Miss Lucy?
Turning back toward Pearly, Lucy had a big smile on her face.
Pearly... don't you think you and I are good enough friends now for you to call me Lucy without the miss?
I think so. I just didn't want to be too forward.
Pearly, believe me, no one could ever accuse you of being too forward.
There's a dance Saturday night. Well, actually, there's a dance in town every Saturday night.
Yeah, I know.
Will you be going?
Why? Would you like me to go?
Yes. I mean, that is, if you're going anyway. I mean, if you want to go.
Yeah, I'll be there.
Oh, good. I'll see you there then.
Lucas Keno was at the Brown Dirt Cowboy Saloon in Fontana. It was still too early in the day for the evening trade, so there were few in the saloon. An empty beer mug and a half-full ashtray conveniently placed by the piano provided the only evidence that anyone ever played the instrument. Keno ordered a beer, then found a table, looked around. There were two people sitting at the table nearest the piano, a middle-aged cowboy and the only bar girl who was working at this hour. The fact that both of them had only one glass before them and that the glass was still half full indicated that the bar girl either found the cowboy's company pleasant or had accepted the slowness of the afternoon. There were brass spittoons conveniently placed around the room, but despite their presence, the floor was riddled with expectorated tobacco quids and chewed cigar butts. The other cowboys who had worked for Jensen during the roundup just passed had gone on to other jobs, and even though he had not been particularly popular with the others, a few of them had even invited Keno to come with them, but he wasn't interested. Before leaving Sugarloaf, Keno had moved 50 head of unbranded Sugarloaf cattle into a hidden box canyon and penned them up inside. His plans were to sell the cattle and get enough money to head down to Arizona or New Mexico or even Texas. It didn't really make that much difference to him where he went, just as long as he left Colorado. Keno was here to meet a man who was going to help him carry out those plans, and as he looked up, he saw the man he was to meet coming through the batwing doors. Toby Jeter was considerably older than Keno, and his hair and beard were laced with gray. He nodded at Keno, then stopped at the bar to buy a beer before he joined Keno at the table.
I found a buyer.
Who is it?
His name is C.D. Montgomery. He's a cattle dealer from over in Wheeler.
Did you tell him when and where to meet me?
He'll be here to talk to you this afternoon.
Good.
When do I get my money?
As soon as I get my money, you'll get your $30.
You didn't say nothing about me having to wait. You told me to find a buyer and you'd pay me.
How do you expect me to pay you before I sell the cows?
All right, I'll wait. But I want 50.
What do you mean? $30 is a month's wages and you didn't do anything for the money.
I set up a meeting for you with a cattle buyer. That's what you asked for.
All right, $50. But it better pay off.
It will. Montgomery buys cattle all the time.
True to his word, Jeter brought Montgomery to the saloon that afternoon. Montgomery was an older man, but his well-kept silver hair, clean-shaven face, and tailored clothes made him a very distinguished-looking figure.
Keno, this here's Mr. Montgomery. This here's Keno.
Mr. Montgomery, have a seat.
Taking out his handkerchief, Montgomery brushed off the chair before he sat down.
Would you like a beer?
Thank you, no.
I reckon that Jeter told you what this was all about, didn't he?
He said you had some cattle for sale.
Yep, I do. 50 head. I know it ain't all that much, but it's all I got at the moment.
All right. Deliver them to me at the railhead and...
You're gonna have to come get them your own self.
I'm gonna have to come get them? See here, that is most unusual. Most of the time when I buy cattle, they are delivered to me.
Yeah, well, this ain't most of the time. And you ain't never got no cattle this good for this cheap.
I don't have any idea how cheap they are. You haven't mentioned the price.
What do you normally pay for cattle?
About $25 a head.
I'll sell them to you for $5 a head.
$5 a head?
That sound good to you?
Yeah, it sounds very good. But I don't understand. Why so cheap? Are these stolen cattle, Mr. Keno?
There ain't a brand on one of them.
You didn't answer my question, Mr. Keno. Are these stolen cattle?
$5 a head. You want them or not?
Where are they now?
They're safe.
$5 a head. You aren't going to change your mind later on now, are you?
No, I ain't going to change my mind.
Yes, I'll take them. When and where do I come for them?
You know where Sugarloaf Ranch is?
Yes, of course I know. I don't think there's anyone in Eagle County who doesn't know where Sugarloaf is.
All right. You come out there just after noon tomorrow.
Where exactly should I come? Sugarloaf is a big ranch. I suppose I could stop by the big house and ask for directions.
No, don't do that. Look, you know where Old Woman Creek goes into the canyon? It's at the far west end of the ranch.
Yes, I know the place.
There's a little thicket of trees there. You come to the trees, I'll meet you there. Bring the money with you. $250.
You'll have the cattle?
Yeah, I'll have them.
Then I will have the money.
Say, Mr. Montgomery, is there any way you could maybe pay $50 now, sort of on good faith, so to speak?
Can you produce 10 cows now on good faith?
No. How would I do that?
Very well, then. I'll see you tomorrow afternoon. Good day to you, Mr. Keno. And to you, Mr. Jeter.
Did you really think he would give you $50 now? What the hell were you thinking about?
I was thinking that if he would give me some of the money in advance, I'd be able to pay you $30 right now and save myself $20 more later on.
Hell, I could have told you a man like C.D. Montgomery wouldn't go along with nothing like that. He's a very rich man. Rich men don't do dumb things. And believe me, asking him for $50 before he had ever seen so much as one cow? Yes, sir, Mr. Keno, that was one dumb thing.
When Lucas Keno saw the cattle buyer approaching, he rode out of the copse of trees and down the little hill to meet him.
Mr. Montgomery, it's good to see you again. You have the money?
I have the money. $250. That's what you asked for. Where are the cattle?
They're right back here in the...
When he turned around, he saw Smoke Jensen, along with Pearly and Cal, riding up behind him, having just emerged from the same copse of trees where he'd been waiting for Montgomery.
Jensen!
Keno.
Mr. Jensen, this here fella is C.D. Montgomery. You want to know where some of your cows have been going? Well, he's been buying them from the thieves that's been taking them. I just smoked them out for you.
Did you now?
Yes, sir. You can check him out for yourself. He's got the money right there in his hand. $250. That's what I told him I wanted for the cows, just to see if he would take the bait, you see.
Here's your money back, Smoke.
Montgomery handed the money over to the ranch owner.
I appreciate the loan.
Thanks, C.D. I appreciate you coming to me about this.
Your money? What do you mean, your money? What's going on here?
C.D. is a friend of mine. When you went to him with the offer to sell him 50 cows for $5 a head, then told him to meet you on Sugarloaf, he came straight to me.
Are you sorry, son of a bitch?
Keno went for his gun, but before he could draw it, Pearly moved his horse quickly toward him, and the action knocked Keno from his saddle. Keno's pistol was knocked across the ground, the wood on the grip shattered by the impact of the bullet.
Don't push it any further.
Smoke was holding a pistol. A small wisp of smoke curled up from the barrel.
All right. So what are you gonna do now? You planning on taking me into town and throwing me in jail?
No, you didn't do anything. You were planning it, but you didn't do it. Be on your way, Keno. And don't bother to ever come back to the Sugarloaf.
You don't have to worry none about that. If I don't never see this place again, it'll be too soon.
Here, I believe this is yours.
Cal handed Keno's pistol back to him.
Hope you don't mind. I took out all the bullets.
Continuing his hateful glare, Keno stuck the empty pistol down into his holster, then turned his horse and rode away. The four men watched Keno for a moment to make certain he was leaving. Then Smoke turned toward Montgomery.
C.D., how about you having lunch with us? And I'm sure Sally can come up with something worth eating. What's so funny?
You're saying you're sure Miss Sally can come up with something worth eating. That's what's funny. Why, Miss Sally's as good a cook, she could stew a boot and it would be good.
A boot? Don't worry, C.D. It'll be more than a boot, I promise you.
It sounds good to me. I'd love to join you.
Come on, Kyle. What do you say me and you get these cows back to where they belong?
I'm right behind you.
More mashed potatoes, Mr. Montgomery?
Oh, yes, please. And a little gravy, too, if you don't mind.
I don't mind at all. Sugarloaf is so far out that having a guest for a meal is actually quite a treat for us.
Trust me, Mrs. Jensen. With the way you cook, it's a lot more of a treat for the guests.
Mr. Montgomery, do you know a man named Byron Davenport?
Why, yes. As a matter of fact, I do know Byron. Quite well, in fact. Why do you ask?
I read in the newspaper that he has signed a contract with the U.S. Army to supply beef.
Well, I'll be. So the deal came through for him, did it? I knew that Byron was working on it. Good for him. I'm glad he was able to pull it off.
The reason I'm asking is, that's going to take a lot of beef, isn't it? I mean, for him to fulfill the contract.
I'll say it's going to take a lot. As a matter of fact, if there's any problem at all with the deal Byron has, it's going to be in managing to buy enough cows to fill the contract.
Do you think Mr. Davenport would be willing to pay a premium price for beef? Say, more than you can pay right now?
Well, now. And here all this time, I thought we were just having a friendly conversation. You are looking at the business side of it, aren't you?
C.D., anyone who knows us knows that Sally is the one who has the business head.
I can see that. Yes, ma'am, Mrs. Jensen. I expect old Byron will have to pay a little extra in order to get all the cows he needs.
The paper said he'll be shipping out from Frisco, so I expect that means anyone who plans to do business with him would probably have to take their cows there.
Walking over to the pie saver, Sally removed an apple pie.
I expect so. Oh, my. Apple pie? I do believe I have died and gone to heaven.
I know that you have bought cattle from us in the past. I hope that you would not be put out if we sold to Mr. Davenport.
Oh, heavens no, Mrs. Jensen. As I told you, Byron is a friend of mine. I want to see him succeed. Besides, I know we will do more business together.
Would you like a piece of cheese on top of the pie?
Oh, you are an angel.
That night, Smoke lay in bed with his hands laced behind his head.
I'll ride down to Frisco sometime next week and see this man Davenport. If he is needing beef the way Montgomery says he is, then he'll probably take at least 1,500 head.
Maybe we shouldn't have let all the cowboys go just yet.
We had to let them go now. Most of them already had other jobs lined up that they needed to get to. If they didn't get there in time, they'd lose out. Why do you think we shouldn't have let them go?
If we do sell some cattle to Byron Davenport...
It's not if, it's when. We will sell him 1,500 head. I have no doubt about that.
All right, let's say we do sell him 1,500 head. So the next question is, how are we going to get them over to Frisco?
Up to 1,500 head is no problem. Pearly, Cal, and I can take them over.
Are you sure? Maybe you ought to take Juan and Carlos with you.
No need to take Juan and Carlos away from their families. I'm sure Pearly, Cal, and I can do it.
Colorado State Prison, Cannon City, Colorado. Reese Van Arnt, prison inmate number 2551, stood in the chamber just outside the warden's office. Half an hour earlier, Van Arnt had taken off his black and white striped prison uniform and was now wearing an ill-fitting dark blue suit. The suit looked even darker when contrasted with Van Arnt's alabaster complexion, for Van Arnt was an albino.
Prisoner Van Arnt!
I ain't a prisoner no more. I get out today.
Van Arnt, you are a prisoner until you step outside to the other side of the penitentiary gate. And we don't have to let you do that until midnight tonight. So I'd watch my step if and I was you.
Van Arnt glared at the guard but didn't say anything.
Go on into the office. Warden Parker will see you now.
Van Arnt walked into the warden's office, then stopped at the line on the floor beyond which no inmate was ever to pass. Parker was sitting behind his desk, and he leaned forward as Van Arnt came in.
Well, Van Arnt, you're leaving us today. I didn't think you'd make it. I thought you'd do something dumb enough to get your sentence extended, or else I thought someone might kill you. And to be honest, I was sort of hoping for the latter.
Sorry to disappoint you, Warden.
Yes, well, I don't plan to be disappointed for long. If you aren't killed within the next 6 months, you'll be back. And the next time you come back, I have no doubt but that you will be staying with us for the rest of your miserable life.
You give that kind of encouraging talk to every prisoner that leaves this place?
Not all of them. Just the no-accounts like you.
Well, I hate to disappoint you, but you have seen the last of Reese Van Arnt. I ain't never coming back to this hellhole.
So you say, Van Arnt. So you say.
He shoved an envelope across the desk.
This is yours. According to Colorado state law, I'm required to give you a train ticket to wherever you want to go in the state. You said you wanted to go to Fairplay, so you got a ticket to there. I must say, though, picking a place by the name of Fairplay for someone like you seems a little strange. You'll find $5 in there as well, which is also required by state law.
$5? I busted rocks and sweated in this hellhole for 3 years, and all I get from it is $5?
$5. Don't spend it all in one place.
Van Arnt picked up the envelope.
Smitty!
The guard stuck his head into the warden's office.
Yes, sir?
Get this maggot-looking bastard out of my sight.
Let's go, you.
Van Arnt shifted positions in the hard seat of the day coach, then looked through the window at the wide open spaces outside. No more than 100 yards away, he saw a couple of coyotes running parallel with the track, actually outpacing the train. Finally, it grew dark outside, and passing through the car, the conductor began lighting kerosene lanterns, including the one just over Van Arnt. Van Arnt reached up and turned it off.
Oh, thank you, sir. That was very kind of you.
What?
Well, you saw I was trying to sleep, so you put out the lantern so as not to keep me awake.
Yeah.
Oh, but I can't sleep none anyway. Don't know why I can't sleep. I stayed up pretty near all last night celebrating my good fortune.
Your good fortune?
Well, it might not be a good fortune to most folks, but $450 is a fortune to me.
Oh, I would say that $450 is a lot of money to just about anyone. What did you do, get lucky at cards?
Oh, no, sir. My wife, Susie, there is no way she would put up with my playing cards. There was a time when I gambled, but no more. Gibbs is my name. Donnie G. Gibbs.
Eddie Mason. So, how did you come by so much money?
Well, sir, I'll tell you. Me and Susie, we got us this real smart little place just outside Como, you see. And for the last 3 years, Susie and me, we've survived just mostly by raising our own vegetables, selling eggs and such. But all along, what we've been doing is we've also been raising a few head of cows until we built us up around 30 head or so. Then, last week, what I done is I cut me out 15 head of cows, and I drove them down to Frisco, where I sold them to a fella for $30 a head.
Donnie stuck his hand into his pocket and pulled out a roll of money.
Here it is. Just in case you ain't never seen that much money at one time.
That's a good-looking lot of money, I have to admit.
If you think that's a lot of money, you should see what they have on deposit in the bank in Frisco. Well, I'll bet they have over $100,000 there.
$100,000? That's a lot of money for a small-town bank, ain't it? Well, why is it they have so much money, do you reckon?
Well, they got all that money because there's a cattleman there, a fellow by the name of Byron Davenport. And he is buying up all the beef he can. He only bought 15 head from me, but I reckon he'll be buying 3,000 head or so before he's all finished and done.
$100,000 in the Bank of Frisco. That sure would be some sight to see.
I reckon it would, but that nobody is going to ever get a chance to look at, though. I expect they'll keep it locked up good and safe.
Gibbs looked more closely at Van Arnt.
Say, Mr. Mason, and I don't mean no insult or nothing, but why is it you're so pale? Are you sick?
Well, I'm what you call an albino. My skin doesn't produce any color. There are a lot of colored people who are albinos, and they're as white as any white man.
You don't say. Are you a colored man or a white man?
I'm a white man.
Well, I'll be. I ain't never seen anything like that. Oh, like I say, I don't mean to be insulting or nothing. I just hope you ain't taking offense.
No offense taken.
The conductor came through the car again.
Folks, the next stop is Grant. We'll be there about 20 minutes, just long enough for you to get yourself some supper. Grant, next stop.
Would you care to have supper with me?
Why, I would be pleased to. Hardest thing about traveling alone is having to eat alone. But when you are lucky to find someone that's such good company as I've just done, why, sitting down to a meal with such a person can be a pure pleasure.
After a supper of ham and fried potatoes, Van Arnt and Gibbs walked out of the Depot Cafe and stood for a moment on the darkened, patterned brick platform. The train that had brought them to Grant was sitting on the track.
Do you think there is any Depot Cafe anywhere in the country that serves anything other than ham and fried potatoes?
That seems to be the standard fare, all right.
No, I have to admit it wasn't bad eating, though it could have been that I was just hungry.
Yeah, I suppose, but damn, look at that.
Van Arnt pointed toward the front of the engine.
Look at what?
Well, I think I saw... No, I know I saw a little child crawling across the track in front of the engine.
What? Are you sure?
Oh, I'm positive. It was a little girl. She must have gotten away from her mother.
Good heavens. She's got no business crawling around on that track. What if she is under the train when it starts? There's no way the engineer could possibly see her. Good Lord, she could be run over and killed.
Yeah, that's what I think too. Come on, let's see if we can find her.
Oh yes, by all means, let's do.
The two men hurried toward the front of the train and then around to the other side.
Where is she? I don't see her.
I don't see her either. Oh, maybe she's under the train.
Oh, heavens, I certainly hope not.
We'd better look. I'll look under the tender, you look under the express car.
Van Arnt leaned over to look under the tender while Gibbs headed for the next car behind. Once Gibbs passed Van Arnt stood up, pulled his knife, then moved quickly until he was standing right behind Gibbs. Sensing Van Arnt's presence, Gibbs turned around.
What is it? Do you see her under the... Mason! What are you...
Quickly, Van Arnt took Gibbs' money before pushing him under the car. Then he walked back around to the depot platform and was standing there when the other passengers came out of the cafe and boarded the train. Van Arn didn't reboard. Instead, he remained on the platform until the train started to leave. Then he hurried into the depot. He saw a man behind the counter. The man was wearing a billed cap with a shield that read Station Master.
Are you the Station Master?
Well, that's what it says on my hat. The name's Travelstead. What can I do for you?
Mr. Travelstead, you better come quick. I think the train just ran over someone as it was leaving the station.
What? What are you talking about? What do you mean you think the train ran over someone?
It was a fella named Gibbs. I'm pretty sure he must have got run over.
You're just pretty sure? Good Lord, man. That's not something you can just casually speculate about. What makes you think this man, Gibbs, did you call him?
Yes, Donnie Gibbs.
What makes you think the train ran over Gibbs? Did you see it happen?
No, I didn't exactly see it, but I'm pretty sure it happened.
Are you and Gibbs friends?
Well, not in particular. The thing is, we met on a train and we come in here to take our supper together. Then after supper, he was standing out here on the depot platform waiting to get back on the train. That's when Gibbs said he seen a baby crawling on the track. I have to tell you, Mr. Travelstead, I looked, but I didn't see nothing. I told him I didn't see nothing, but he was bound and determined to go rescue the baby. So round the train he went. I waited for him, but he didn't come back. Then when the train pulled away, I thought maybe he'd be standing on the other side, but he wasn't.
Are you sure he didn't come back? Don't you think it could be that he got out of the train without you seeing him?
I suppose that could be so, but I have to tell you, I was watching pretty close, and I sure didn't see him come back. I hate to say it, Mr. Travelstead, but I got me this awful feeling that somehow poor old Gibbs fell on the track and got himself rubbed over.
Well, I reckon we'd better check.
Van Arnt went out with Travelstead.
Where'd you see him last?
Let me see. I believe the engine was sitting right about there, and old Gibbs, after he seen the little girl, or else thought he seen the little girl, went around in front of the engine. So I reckon about there is where I seen him last.
Well, the track is too dark to see from here. Well, let me get a lantern. We'll take a closer look.
Travelstead went and got a lantern, and they walked up the track. It didn't take long to find the gruesome sight. Blood and intestines were everywhere, as well as brain matter from the severed head.
Mark. God, oh, this is awful. What did you say your friend's name was?
Oh, he said his name was Gibbs. Donnie Gibbs. But he wasn't my friend, exactly. We was just on the train together, is all. Like I told you, all we done is we just ate supper. Then after supper, we come back outside and was standing here talking when he said he seen a little girl crawling across the track. That's when he went up to the front of the train looking for it.
I don't think there was a baby. If so, the mother would have come to ask me about it. I'll send a telegram back to all the stations along the line and try to find out if anyone knows anything about this man Gibbs.
The ill-fitting blue suit that had literally screamed prison issue was gone, replaced by a pair of denim trousers and a white shirt. The clothes, like the black hat and the brown boots he was wearing, were new. Van Arnt had used Gibbs's money to buy himself new duds to include a new pistol and holster. He had bought a new horse and saddle as well, but rather than ride the 50 miles to Frisco, he had taken the train, buying passage for his horse in the attached stock car. Stepping down from the train, Van Arnt saw a town that was alive with commerce. The streets were filled with the traffic of wagons, buckboards, and horses. Men and women moved up and down the boardwalks and went in and out of the many stores that fronted Center Street. Next to the depot was a large holding pen, and though it was almost empty at the moment, the ground was redolent with the droppings of thousands of cattle deposited over the last several months. This was both visual and olfactory evidence of the cattle commerce carried on at the Frisco Railhead. Retrieving his horse from the attached stock car, Van Arnt led the animal down the street to a livery where he made arrangements for it to be boarded. Then he walked back up the street to the Railroad Hotel, which was just across from the depot, and there he took a room. After that, he went to the bank to have a look around at the way the bank was laid out. If this little bank really did have $100,000, as Gibbs had stated, Then Van Aert intended to relieve it of that burden. The bank was unremarkable in that it resembled all the other banks in all the other towns Van Aert had seen. Just inside the door was a table on which there were bank deposit slips and counterdrafts. A little farther back were the teller's cages.
May I help you, sir? Do you wish to make a deposit?
I might.
Van Aert stepped up to the cage and handed the teller three $20 bills.
But first I would like to have these bills changed into tens, if you don't mind.
Why, I don't mind at all, sir.
I have a lot of money in the bank in Denver. I plan to buy some cattle while I'm here, and so I would like to move my money to this bank, but I'm a little worried.
Worried? May I ask what you're worried about, sir? Perhaps I can ease your fears.
Well, I'm sure you can understand why I'm worried. It's just that the bank in Denver is rather substantial, and I'm absolutely certain that my money is safe as long as it is there. Please, don't get me wrong, sir. I truly mean no insult, but you must admit that this is a rather small bank, and I just imagine you don't have a lot of money on deposit.
Well, now, that's just where you are wrong, sir. It just so happens that we have well over $100,000 on deposit right now, and at least $80,000 of that money is deposited in one account.
Is that a fact?
Yes, sir, it is a fact.
That must be quite a wealthy man to have so much money on one account.
I think he represents an industry that is wealthy, but he is not in the least worried about the safety or efficiency of our bank. So I'm sure you can see that regardless of the size of your account, we will quite be able to handle it.
All the time the teller had been talking, he'd been counting out money.
There you go, sir. $60 and $10 banknotes.
Van Aert picked up the six $10 bills, folded them over, and stuck them in his pocket.
Well, I thank you very much. You've been very helpful. I'll be returning to Denver soon, and when I do, I'll draw the money out and bring it back here for deposit.
We'll look forward to doing business with you, Mr...
Yes, thank you. I'll see you when I get back.
In his hotel room that night, Van Aert developed the plan he would use in order to relieve the bank of its money. During his time in prison, he had met three men that he believed would be helpful to him. One thing that made them particularly valuable to him was the fact that he knew them, but they didn't know each other. And for the time being, they wouldn't know him, for he had no plans to sign the letters. It was going to cost him $60 to put the plan into operation, but $60 was little enough to spend for the return he expected from his investment. Van Aert wrote the three letters. Then, as he put the letters into the addressed envelopes, he also included two $10 bills in each one. Because he knew the men, he was certain that the money would get their attention. Tomorrow, he would take the letters down to the post office and put them in the mail. A line shack in Gunnison County. Zeb Tucker had been the first to arrive, reaching the line shack by following the directions in the letter. The letter had contained two $10 bills, along with a promise for much more money if he would follow the directions.
Following the directions above, you should arrive at the shack no earlier than 1 o'clock and no later than 2 o'clock on Thursday the 7th instant. You will be the first to arrive. You will find that the shack has been stocked with enough food and coffee to provide supper that night and breakfast the next morning for three people. You are to be one of the three I have chosen. Stick a white feather in your hat band. The other two men are also being instructed to mark their hat with a white feather. This will be the signal of recognition among you. Be wary of anyone who is not wearing this signal of recognition. Each of you will be given a few random words. When you put the random words together, it will form a sentence of instruction that will prepare you to take the next step. Your words are, Tucker, read instructions found.
Tucker had no idea where the instructions he was supposed to read were found, but he assumed it would be made clear to him when the other two arrived. He located the coffee and had just made a pot when he heard a horse approaching from outside. Making certain he had a white feather in his hat, he pulled his pistol, then stepped into a shadowed corner of the room so he could watch the door. The man who stepped in through the door was also wearing a white feather in his hat.
Anybody in here?
Yeah, I'm over here. You have a letter with you?
Yeah.
Name's Tucker.
I'm Clay.
That's your first or your last name?
Clay.
According to my letter, there will be three of us.
Yeah, that's what my letter said as well.
You have any idea who sent the letter?
I don't have a clue, but there was $20 in it, with the promise of more.
As the two men were talking, they heard the third man approaching, and they stepped out front so they could watch him as he rode up. He was wearing a white feather in his hat.
Do you know who this fella is?
No, I never seen him before in my life.
Interesting. Whoever the fella is sent us these letters. Seems like he just don't want us to know each other.
Because the two men standing in front of the line shack were both wearing white feathers in their hats, the rider continued his approach without apprehension.
Hello, boys. The name is Rollins. Either you boys know what this is all about?
No, but now that all three of us are together, I reckon we'll be finding out soon enough.
When Rollins went inside, the three men compared their letters and found that each of them had only one part of a cryptic message. Putting it together gave them the first step.
Tucker, read instructions found on the top bunk under the red blanket.
Tucker opened the envelope they found under the red blanket, read it quickly, then looked up at the others.
I'll be damned.
What is it?
Why don't I just read it to you? If you have found this letter, that means all three of you are together. What I propose is difficult and dangerous, but the reward is great. If all goes as it should, we will be dividing
$100,000. $100,000? Is that what you said?
That's what it says here.
I ain't never seen that much money at one time in my life. I didn't even know there was that much money in the world.
Go on, finish reading the letter.
At this point, make certain that you are agreed to carry out my instructions. Tucker, if even one man says he does not want to do this, do not read any further. Are you both in?
Yeah! Hell yes, I say we do it.
Me too. Read the rest of the letter.
At the present time, there is on deposit at the bank in Frisco, Colorado, over $100,000. I have checked the bank out myself. There are no armed guards and only two tellers. The tellers are meek-mannered men and unarmed. Use your guns and you will get no resistance. After you get the money, return to this cabin. I will be here to meet you, and at that time, we will divide the money four ways.
Wait a minute. I don't know about this. I mean, if you think about it, we're the ones taking the risk. But whoever this fella is who wrote the letter is gonna get his share? That don't seem right.
Yeah, but don't forget, it's $100,000. And even split four ways, $100,000 is,
$25,000.
Yeah, $25,000.
Son of a bitch. That is a lot of money.
So what do you say? Do we do it?
Yes! Hell yes! I say we do it!
Now, what do you think, Tucker? You feel all right with this?
Well, for one thing, you've already said that you would. And for another thing, whoever wrote this is the one who found the bank. And he is also the one who found us. It appears to me that he seems to have it all planned out. So you tell me, Clay, are you willing to just walk away from your share of $100,000 just because you think it's not fair?
No, I guess not. If you two are going along with it, well, I reckon I will too.
There's one thing I don't understand. How does this fella, whoever he is, know that we ain't gonna just take the money and ride away without giving him his share?
Well, think about it. Do you know who he is or what he looks like?
No, I don't.
Do you know who it is, Clay?
No.
Uh-huh, and neither do I. But the thing is, he does know who we are. And not only that, I'd bet a dollar to a dime that he knows exactly what each one of us looks like.
So? What does that have to do with it?
Well, suppose we took the money and didn't give him his share. He could come right up to one of us, shoot us if he wanted to, and we wouldn't even know to be worried because we wouldn't know who he was.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I guess you have got a good point at that. Anyway, like I said, I'm all for it. Clay, it's up to you.
No, it ain't up to him. At this point, I figure on doing it with or without him.
I'm in.
Not one for riding in a buckboard, Smoke let Sally drive the rig while he rode next to it. As he rode down the trail toward town, Smoke glanced down at Sally, recalling the way the moon had made her silk nightgown glimmer like molten silver the other night. When it suited her to do so, Sally wore men's pants, and she was doing so this morning, but it did not detract one bit from her femininity. This morning she was carrying a silver-plated .32 revolver. She wasn't a fast draw artist, but she was smooth with the revolver, and she always hit where she aimed. Smoke was actually leaving for Frisco this morning in order to meet with Byron Davenport so he could make arrangements for selling his cattle. It would have been a lot quicker to go by train, and he did intend to return by train, but he intended to go on horseback all the way from Big Rock to Frisco in order to scout the best route for driving the cattle. Sally chose this morning to come into town as well, not only to prolong her goodbye to Smoke, but also so she could do some shopping. When they reached Big Rock and rode down Main Street, they saw Sheriff Monte Carson standing on the boardwalk in front of his office, drinking a cup of coffee. As Smoke and Sally rode past the sheriff's office, the sheriff raised his cup in a salute.
Morning, Smoke. Sally, where are you two headed?
Meet me at Longmont's and I'll tell you about it.
Carson nodded and then he pitched his coffee into the dirt. Smoke and Monte Carson had become very good friends over the past few years. Carson had once been a well-known gunfighter, though he'd never ridden the Owl Hoot Trail. Smoke was responsible for the fact that Carson was the sheriff of Big Rock. It had all come about when an ambitious and totally unscrupulous rancher named Tilden Franklin made plans to take over the county. He hired Carson to be the sheriff of Fontana, a town just down the road from Smoke's Sugarloaf spread. When Carson learned that the man's plans were to have a sheriff who would wink at his lawlessness, he put his foot down and informed Franklin that Fontana was going to be run in a law-abiding manner from then on. Franklin, with the intention of showing Carson who was the real boss of Fontana, sent a bunch of his riders into town to teach the upstart sheriff a lesson. The men seriously wounded him and killed Carson's two deputies, taking over the town. In retaliation, Smoke founded the town of Big Rock, and he, Sheriff Carson, and the band of aging gunfighters returned to Fontana to clean house and make things right. When the fracas was over, Smoke offered the job of sheriff of Big Rock to Monte Carson. Carson accepted the offer and wound up marrying a grass widow and settling into the sheriff's job as if he'd been born to it. Neither Smoke nor the citizens of Big Rock ever had cause to regret the fact that Carson had taken the job. Now, aging somewhat, heavy-set, and growing a bit of a paunch, thanks both to his wife's excellent cooking and his aversion to any real physical labor, Carson still had the qualities that made a good sheriff. He was quick and deadly accurate with a handgun, and he was honest. If you obeyed the law and didn't cause any trouble in his town, you would have no trouble with him. Cross the law, and a significant number of young gunnies learned that age and weight had not lessened the sheriff's effectiveness.
Smoke, you go down to Longmont's. I'll join you in a little while. I need to stop into Lucy's dress emporium for a few minutes.
You're buying another dress with as many dresses as you have in the armoire? Don't get me wrong, I think you're beautiful in any dress you choose to wear. Heck, you're beautiful even when you aren't wearing anything at all.
If you're trying to make me blush right here in front of everybody, it isn't going to work.
Sally, I've gave up trying to make you blush a long time ago. It's just that you don't choose to wear dresses all that often. I mean, look at what you're wearing right now. I'm just wondering why you would even want another dress is all.
For your information, Mr. Jensen, it just so happens that the dress I am buying this morning will not be for me. It just so happens that Maria's birthday is coming up this week, and this dress is for her.
Oh, yes, Maria's birthday. I'd forgotten about that. Yes, if this is for Maria, be my guest.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen, for your permission. Not that I needed it.